Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 169 and is brought to you by Menla Retreat and Dewa Spa.
Of Buddhism and of India. Of course, the Brahmins, who forgot about the Buddhist contribution to India, they think that it came from Brahma and, you know, Ayurveda and from Dandantara, you know, some of these rishis. And of course, great knowledge did come from them. However, there's a scholar named Kenneth Zisk, who is American, but he teaches in Denmark. And he's elderly now, and he wrote a wonderful book. I forgot the title. It was a forgettable title, but it was about the history of Indian medicine. And he fills in the gap that is logically there, which is that the Brahmins are, you know, even the name for the medical tradition by them is called Ayurveda. But Ayurveda, knowledge of long life, because Ayu means long life, is one of eight branches of Buddhist medicine, the longevity branch, you know, like gerontology or whatever we call it, gerontology, or dealing with elderly people like me, and to give them long life, and that's what they're interested in. But it's only one branch in Buddhist medicine, Indian and Tibetan Buddhist medicine, gynecology, pediatrics, surgery, pharmacology, etc. There are all these other branches. And Ayur is a long life, is one of them. Also, you know, virility, you know, they had their own Viagras, definitely, to see to it about progeny and things like that, fertility. So they had like eight branches, basically. And Ayurveda emphasizing the long life one, because the Brahmins, like, they have this thing, they're not going to be dealing with lower caste people. They don't have the same pulse diagnosis as Tibetan and Chinese medicine do, because they don't want to touch people. So it's unlikely that, it is likely, and this gives a lot of evidence, but it's hard to find evidence because the Buddhist phase of Indian history, which was from Buddha's time about 1,000 years really strong, and then the last 500 years even more strong, and almost in a way, but very intermingled in the last 500 years. And that's totally got lost then, once the Muslims destroyed all of the Buddhist institutions, and then the Brahmins reasserted their thing about the caste system. So Buddhism was very erosive, not violently, but very revolutionary about not considering the caste system so rigid, or what we call, what you call in social science terms, ascriptive caste membership. In other words, you have to be in the same caste. In other words, in the Buddhist thing, you was more flexible. There's more mobility. And there's a lot of records from certain literature from the Buddhist tradition that it was a background society that is depicted in the literature, not the main story, but the background society shows that actually the caste system was much less rigid during the golden period of Indian history. And you had untouchable sort of, or chandalas who became kings. You had Brahmins who were fishermen, ferrymen. You know, it was like it would move back and forth. It was not a fixed, so it's such a fixed thing. And in the Pali texts of Buddhas, the Buddha very often gets into real tangles with some serious young Brahmins who are very uppity, kind of, and they're like, well, we don't know. We're not going to really sit down and listen to you because you're this whatever. You have no caste. You know, you have shaved head. You know, you're like, you have barefoot, you know. And you're originally a Kshatriya, but we don't know what you are now, you know. Like, they actually talk to him like that, and then he gets after them. And then he's clairvoyant, and he knows their past lineage. So he says, well, 7 grandmothers ago, you had an untouchable lady who married so-and-so. And they freaks them out. And they have quite sparky dialogues. And then they kind of calm down, and then he teaches them, and then they become inspired. But sometimes they have a little critical clash. They do. They definitely do. And he's very sharp about the casting. Can be. For example, there's one guy who was really being snotty with him. He says, well, you come from and it relates to a color thing, too, like our racist thing here. You know, the lower castes were darker because they probably came from the older civilization before the people wandered in from Central Asia, the Aryan, so-called. And and so there's a color thing. So he says to this one Brahmin who's particularly snotty because he has a good knowledge of the Vedas, and he says, well, actually, your great-grandmother was this and that, and they proved it with the name and this and that. Finally, he admitted that he knew that or he'd heard that. And then the other Brahmins, who for whom he was a kind of ringleader, started really saying, oh, we don't want to talk to you. Oh, get off. And then he starts scolding them for being like that. You know, so it's quite interesting. People really should read, just, you know, get the Digha Nikaya, the Long Discourses, or one of these kind of books. And just read through just to get the feeling of the flavor of the Buddhist time, you know. Because it's really quite amazing what the sort of the nature of things in the ancient Indian society. So anyway, so the Buddhist medicine in India was probably seminal, like most of the, in logic, in physics, in psychology, in yoga, it was always very seminal because they developed the universities. They didn't try democracy. They had kings, but they supported the king, listening to ministers, having councils, and as I said, they created a space in the society where caste no longer ruled, where a low caste person who was senior as a monk or a nun to a high caste person was superior in that community to that formerly high caste person. So that high caste person had to defer and be respectful because of being elder as a monk, even physically, maybe not elder. So the Buddha did things like that to erode the rigidity of the caste system. And therefore, when the Muslims destroyed the Buddhist institution, then the Brahmins came out of the families, and then they kind of reasserted and they became more rigid again, as they are today, indeed, even in spite of Gandhi's constitution and everything. But they're working on it, because there is the idea of, you know, overcoming caste in the Indian constitution. And now we're doing Medicine Buddha. Okay, so let's get on with the Medicine Buddha. Now, if you look at Medicine Buddha, and it's a barrel, is the word, and a barrel, a sapphire is a barrel, and it's a translucent but very dark blue, a sapphire is, right? And a lot of people translate it as lapis lazuli, but lapis lazuli is not transparent; it's opaque, so it can't be lapis lazuli. It's Vaidurya. It's the word Vaidurya, because he's called Vaidurya Prabhāraja. One of the names of Medicine Buddha is the King of Vaidurya Light, which is beryl. Actually, it usually translates in dictionaries as beryl. And the beryl crystal is a sapphire, emerald, ruby. These are beryls. Diamond is not a beryl. It's a little different one. But so anyway, never mind that. But he's light blue. Now, he has in his bowl, on his left hand, he has the three, which are in this painting, have different colors. There's leaves coming, and then there's these three nuts, fruits or nuts, you could say. And this called, which are called Myrobalan. And there are different varieties. It's Aru, Baru, and Kuru in Tibetan. And Arura in Sanskrit is the most important one. And these are kind of panacea medicinal plants. And then the other thing is that in his right hand, which is in the boon-granting gesture, giving a gift, gift-giving gesture, he holds the stalk of another plant, which you can see this comes up here behind him. And there should be more Arura plants there. I guess the red ones up there are supposed to be Arura fruits up higher up on that. And there's a nice book by David Crowe called In Search of the Medicine Buddha. It's a kind of flowery, but it's his own history of seeking to tell us a little bit about Tibetan medicine. It's quite nice. And it talks about how Buddha, the medicine Buddha, is holding the plant because the plant is our friend, the friend of the human being. And it comes from the Medicine Buddha Sutra, which is a sort of ancient thing, that there were seven brothers in another universe, billions of aeons ago. They became Buddhas, all seven of them at once. I don't know how they managed that, but they did. And they particularly were expert about healing and medicine and understanding the nature of mind and body and so on. And they were known as the seven medicine Buddhas. And then, according to the sutra, the legend, they looked forward and backward in time, because Buddhas are present in all moments of time. When you become a Buddha, you're not only everywhere in space, but you're also everywhere, every when in time. So you're not isolated in a moment, like when you're not in the future, not in the past, like a normal, ignorant person. You are everywhere in time, which of course is inconceivable, but you are. So they looked way forward in time and they said, oh, on that planet, which we call Saha, and the Buddhas call our planet Saha. Saha means tolerable, in the sense of barely tolerable, sort of just tolerable. So it's not a paradise, it's in a way, like as we fantasize about heavenly paradises. So they said, in that universe, there will be 1,000 Buddhas that will go there. But the fourth of those 1,000 Buddhas is the particularly most brave one, because he takes rebirth and he gives his teaching. He takes his final Buddha birth, rather. Buddhas are always taking rebirth everywhere, but he takes his final Buddha birth in a time on that planet when beings are relatively short-lived, human beings. They only live 100 years, more or less, except in unusual circumstances. And there's a lot of warfare and violence. And also they get sick a lot. So we should go and inspire him, and we should propagate the Medicine Buddha teachings when he gives his teaching, because people will need to heal themselves so they'll be able to study and use his teachings, which is what he wants them to do, and to find out their own true nature, you know. And so they then went, and then he became they sort of inducted him, Shakyamuni, and he became the eighth medicine Buddha. And at a moment in his teaching career in Vaishali, which is the same city where Vimalakirti lived, actually. It was like New York or something, or Chicago, big city, San Francisco, and on a famous river, a very wealthy city. And in that city, a certain assembly came, thousands of people, and gods also, and rishis, you know. I think I have a picture here somewhere with this. Yeah, this one. And many rishis came, and many bodhisattvas from other universes and things, besides the eight medicine Buddhas, who are up on top there, you see. I think there's eight of them. One, two, three, four, one, two, there's a ninth one, I don't know who that is. But there's supposed to be eight of them, basically. And he manifested this Pure Land of the medicine, which is what is depicted here in this painting. Originally, this is a copy of a painting originally from the 17th century, late 17th century, time of the fifth Dalai Lama, between the fifth and sixth Dalai Lamas, by the regent who was the spiritual son of the fifth Dalai Lama. He commissioned these paintings. And so all of this, so inside the mandala with him, there are what are called the four audiences. And these four audiences are the Indian gods, you know, Brahma, Vishnu, Ganesha, Shiva, they're all there, and some goddesses. And then there are the celestial bodhisattvas, like Manjushri and Avalokiteshvara and people like that. And then over here are the rishis, you know, with the long hair, the Indian. I'm sorry, I can't sort of expand it. I can expand it a little. Over here, yeah, you can see that detail. And there, over here, there are these rishis who are the, you know, the Indian seers, you know, over here. And then up here are the Buddhist monks. So those were his four main disciples. Although whenever a Buddha teaches, all of these all kinds of strange creatures show up in the sky who are invisible to the normal people. And somehow, it's sort of like Occupy Wall Street. He doesn't have any sound equipment or megaphones or anything, but everyone in a huge, vast audience perceives him as if he was right in front of them. And then as if he's speaking personally to them. It's a special gift that a Buddha has, that everyone sees them as very close, even if they're way in the back row, sees the Buddha as being very close. And also, if they speak a different language, they hear him giving the teaching in another language. He doesn't need translators. It's like Star Trek or something. You know, it's like universal translation energy is around. So that these are called the Avinika Dharma, two of the 18 Avinika Dharmas of the Buddha, meaning the uncommon properties of a Buddha. That everyone hears him in their own language, and they all see him as right immediately in front of them. And so then, he turns blue in that color. And the blue color may symbolize, it's called, it generally in tantric symbology, let's say, it symbolizes what's called the ultimate reality, perfection, wisdom. The wisdom of the perfection of ultimate reality, and which is the transmutation of the addictive emotion of hatred. Because hatred, it's a wisdom, ultimate reality, perfection, wisdom. And it's because, hate, anger or hatred is connected with intelligence, because it wants to take things apart, you know. Intelligence wants to analyze and understand things in terms of their parts, so it sort of disassembles things. Hello, Jana. How are you? You don't have to bend over like that. It's okay. And so that symbolizes that this is all-knowing awareness. And also the radiance, this Vaidurya Prabha Raja, he's called the king of the beryl or the sapphire light, which means that this blue light that radiates from him is infinitely healing. It turns, you know, hatred in a way is almost the worst, one of the worst of the addictive poisons that are the root of this life of suffering. Ignorance, of course, is the root of the roots, but hatred is the most destructive one, you know, very difficult. So it's like he has taken the energy of hatred, which wants to disassemble and destroy things, and turned it into destroying ignorance and being aware of the reality, the perfection of ultimate reality. And it's a rather darker blue, even. It can be mistaken as black, actually. And then, around him, in the field of this thing, are all these plants, and there's some mineral springs up here. There are mineral springs, and there are some animals also. See, there people are bathing in hot springs of different types, cold springs and hot springs, which they have a lot of in Tibet and in the Himalayan area of India. And then there's, this is in the western direction. In the northern direction, there's all kind of cooling plants that grow, herbal plants and fruits and different things, which are grow with the power of moonlight in the northern direction. It's the cool direction. And each of these has a specific name, and you know, there's only a small amount of the huge Tibetan pharmacopoeia. And in the eastern side, there are these different kinds of myrobalan or arura and barura and kurura trees, which are these trees that grow especially in India. Although I think they should, I have a friend, I want to get them to grow them in Hawaii. And they could be grown in Florida, I'm sure, actually, or in any sort of semi, a little more tropical place. And those are the celestial arura trees that grow in certain lower level paradises, they are key, heal any sickness, is the idea. And that's what the plant that he's holding is that one. And there you can see the monks and the rishis. And the those are the celestial bodhisattvas. And then these are the Hindu deities up here. And Brahma, the deity Brahma, the four-faced one, he is actually a bodhisattva, as it turns out. He's a great bodhisattva himself. Because he's been there for three or four Buddhas, and so he finally had to study a little. Okay. So, okay, can you have a picture of that? And then the property, what happened, all the people from Vaishali who came and all the people, when they were within the field, and this, of course, is a mandala palace here in the center, and then there's like a city of medicine. You see, these are like hospitals, doctors' residences. It's like around that, it's like all these little houses, like a little city, which is also unusual, that there's a place for all the doctors and the patients to come to and the doctors to live. You see all around? There are. And another unusual thing is he's facing south. In the and down in the south, the hot medicines that help alleviate conditions of cold in the system, you know, spicy, hot things, they grow and with the solar power down in the south, you know, with the sun power in the south. And he faces the south, which is usually in mandalas, the deity, the central Buddha figure, whoever it may be, is faces east. And so the east is usually the bottom of a mandala when it's two-dimensional like that. But in this case, it's the south. And this is just one, this is his teaching moment, and this is his Pure Land, which is called Sudarshana, which means beautiful to behold. And the thing about the Sudarshana is that when you're present in the presence of Medicine Buddha, your vision changes of life around you. And that you suddenly, everything looks like medicine to you. And it always makes me think of a figure that some of you older people will remember with me, Ewell Gibbons. You remember Ewell Gibbons? And I always remember when he visited Johnny Carson one night. And when he came out on the stage and he said, now we have a guest, you know, Ewell Gibbons. You know? And then when he came out on the stage, Johnny Carson came out from behind his desk and he put his arms like this, like he was protecting the couch where Ewell Gibbons was going to sit. And so people were saying that Ed McMahon or something said, like, well, why are you doing that, Johnny? He said, well, I don't know. Ewell might eat it. I don't want to eat the couch. Meaning that it was Ewell Gibbons, it was this guy, this nature guy, you know, an herbal and medicine and plants and things. And he was into how every plant has medicine. And the whole, all of nature is growing there symbiotically with us, right? Not just the exchange of oxygen and carbon, but also every kind of thing, there's a cure to everything is in all the plants. Because this is the environment in which it's created around us by the blessings of many, many benevolent spirits and by our own really good karma. In the Buddhist view, we all have really good karma to have become human beings from all kinds of other life forms. Being human is an incredible privilege and an incredible gift. And with that life that we have as a human, we can achieve an incredible understanding, which helps us forever, you know, is the idea, you know. So the plants are there to help us, you see. They're Medicine Buddha's healing army is the plants. And so when you're in the Medicine Buddha mandala, you see everything as even poison, even arsenic, even the deadliest thing, the snake venom. In maybe a tiny amount is a homeopathic healing thing, or it's like a, you know, like so everything, if you have the knowledge of its nature and how it relates, it's all healing, is the idea. And I'm just mentioning that particularly because Tibet House has a place in the north or in the Catskills, southern Catskills, but north of here, which is called Menla, which is the Tibetan word for the Medicine Buddha. And that's our ambition. When anybody steps on the property there, they'll immediately feel that everything is positive around them, every plant, even the weeds, even the mosquitoes. But maybe the ticks, they have a hard time with the ticks, of course. But the deers who bring the ticks, they all run around there very free. We have this little special hidden valley that there are no neighbors. In the middle of a national forest. So that's our ambition, to reproduce that. Okay, so there we are, Medicine Buddha. Now let's meditate together a little bit, I think, in honor of Medicine Buddha. Okay.
This episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast is a part of the ongoing series Force for Good. To watch more free teachings from the Force for Good series, please visit Tibet House US on YouTube and visit tibethouse.us to learn about the next Force for Good class series with Robert Thurman and friends. This episode's proud sponsor is Menla Retreat. Menla offers year-round personal wellness getaways, which include private accommodations, delicious healthy cuisine, daily meditation, access to the world-class Dewa Healing Spa, as well as gorgeous hikes around the enchanting Catskill Mountains. To learn more, visit menla.us.
Okay, now let's meditate together a little bit, I think, in honor of Medicine Buddha. Okay? Now, if you're a doctor or a healer, you take one of the courses that you take in medical school is the Medicine Buddha course. And that involves learning to meditate. And you get an initiation into the Medicine Buddha mandala. And there are various kinds of Medicine Buddha mandalas. And you do what we will now sort of rehearse, let's say, which is that you sort of calm yourself and sit quietly. Take a few breaths. Gently. And then you turn your awareness toward yourself, as if you are looking into your own face. And Mark Epstein loves that. The mindfulness, Anapanasati, the Satipatthana Sutta, the mindfulness, the focus of mindfulness sutra. He loves it how it says you set up your mindfulness in front of you. And I think that's he particularly likes the way they say that. And I think that refers to this thing, which is a Tibetan thing, showing the vastness of the Buddhist knowledge on the level of the practical knowledge, where you imagine that you're looking into your own face. And you're doing so, and you have X-ray vision, of course, because you're this disembodied, imagining looker, seer. And you look into your brain, you look into your whole physiology and what your heart pumping, your circulation going, your neural impulses shooting electrically around, breath going in, oxygen going into the alveoli in the lungs and into the bloodstream, and carbon being deposited in the lungs and being exhaled and so on. So you look into all of this amazing process of yourself. And your tummy digesting the nice dinner that you had earlier, the least snack. And you looked entirely at everything. And because you're looking to see who you really are. And actually, when you do that, even if for a split second, you will feel a little confused. Because, of course, you think of yourself, your image of yourself relates to when you see your face in the mirror. But when you're looking at your face in this way, you realize that your face is a kind of mask and your whole process is some really much more complicated thing. And then you're looking in there for something that feels like home, like you. If it's your optical field, you're looking at the sort of the ultimate register, like the digital registry of your visual field, or the film on which the image coming through the optic nerves is reflected. But you don't find anything. So you become a little dizzy and kind of a little swirling, a little confused in your mind, like, what am I, sort of thing. And you let go of maintaining any particular kind of sense of secure identity, if you can. So you just sort of let go, and you just be there. Where, and you even begin, you're not even sure where, actually. And, you know, you can do this first part. This is just the initial part. You can do it lots of ways. You can think of yourself as a collocation of atoms within the molecules and the cells. And then you realize atoms are mostly like little tiny zipping things, zipping around in mostly empty space. That's a far cry from your habitual sense of self-identity, physical self-identity. Well, you do that. And then, when you've let go, kind of, and you're sort of open as far as your identity goes, you arise and be all that you can be. As they say in that commercial, you be what you might feel is your ideal persona for meditating. Balanced, alert, feeling awake but not excited, calm but alert. And then you imagine around you a completely different environment. You imagine you're in the pure land of the medicine Buddha. You're in his mandala of the healing plants all around, in the company of the gods and the heavenly bodhisattvas and the monks and the rishis, inside the mandala palace. And then in front of you there, a little bit above, and whatever size you like to think of it, is the medicine Buddha himself. Shakyamuni himself turned into one of the eighth medicine Buddha, radiating this blue light, and the dark blue light sort of imperceptibly floods into you and makes you feel really as if the perfection of reality, actual real reality, ultimate reality, is you and is everything around you, and you feel completely peaceful. You may, if you've studied a little Buddhism, you may realize that you're never apart, you have never been apart from nirvana, actually, the uncreated, the primordial. So you're just full of a plenitude of energy that's, however, very calm and still in its plenitude. It's not like bubbling to shoot off somewhere because it's so full and it's expands outward everywhere, so there's nothing, no big need around you. And you bathe in this flowing blue light, and the rays of the blue light coming from Medicine Buddha, you try to see the Medicine Buddha's face. He has a little tuft of white hair from which light rays radiate on the middle of his forehead. His general complexion is this dark, dark blue that is a radiant dark blue, though. Cobalt kind of like blue energy, it flows to you, fills you up, and you feel just wonderful in the presence of Medicine Buddha. And then you repeat his mantra by following after me at first, without making it too loud, in a murmuring way, Om. Say Om. Om. Baishajya. Baishajya. Mahabaishajya. Baishajya Raja. Samudgate. Swaha. Om Vaishaja Vaishaja. Mahabhaishaja. Vaishaja Raja. Samudgate 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 Swaha. Okay, good. So you offer those mantras to the Vaishaja Guru in the sitting in the space in front of you, radiating and smiling at you, actually, and radiating blue light rays toward you. And if you are particularly hungering for a different color, like an orange or a green or a red or a yellow or a white, you can imagine that the blue rays coming from the Vaishaja Guru split like prismatically, rainbow-like, and they flood into you with multiple colors if you prefer. And you just sit and bathe in that, and you feel that this blue, dark blue / rainbow energy is healing every cell in your body, filling you with calm and soothing, you know, blissful, peaceful energy. And you just bathe in that and you enjoy it. Then you can add a few elements. You can add around you, or all, maybe outside the mandala, but visible to you through walls or whatever, it's all luminous, are all the beings in the world, but in human form. All the animals are also there, but at the moment they're in human form, they say. And in the front rows are beings that you recognize, your loved ones in the front rows toward the left, the neutral ones straight ahead in the front rows, and the unloved ones who irritate you no end and bother you in the front rows on the right. And yet, as this blue rainbow light fills you up with this immensely positive, buoyant feeling, it reflects from you to all of those beings equally. And you feel that it just automatically, you become a reflector of the medicine Buddha's healing light to all of them. Although you can, you know, you can embroider however you want the visualization and have rays coming straight from the medicine Buddha to all of them as well. But particularly here, you're sort of putting yourself in a focus position of transmitting or sharing the medicine Buddha's light blessing with all beings, unloved as well as loved, unknown as well as known, so that your enjoyment of this blissful energy is shared universally, which just increases your enjoyment of it, actually. You don't feel you're depriving yourself by reflecting, as you're already filled with this inconceivable, blissful, deep sapphire energy. And then, just to complete this sequence, if you are a doctor or healer, and if you're in this training specifically, and if you are initiated, then you imagine that the medicine Buddha is so pleased with you that you are focused in this way. The medicine Buddha you're seeing up there in front of you, that he becomes more and more miniature and floats down to you and then merges through the crown of your head, your brain chakra, and he goes down your central channel, his presence and energy, and he occupies the center of your heart chakra, which is in the center of your body at the height of the heart back toward the spine, where the central channel goes in front of the, a little bit in front of the spine. And you imagine that medicine Buddha is therefore actually in your heart, the real medicine Buddha. And then you can go further and imagine that you become the medicine Buddha. And you are sitting and you turn blue and you radiate out to all the beings as indivisible from medicine Buddha yourself. It's not like you just have to sit back and wait for Medicine Buddha to do it. Medicine Buddha fuses with you and you become Medicine Buddha. And of course, it takes a little doing to sort of develop a state of mind where you can feel confident that you are actually the Medicine Buddha. At first, a channel, and then the actual Medicine Buddha as perceived by others in your vast field of acquaintance and karmic interconnection, and that therefore the medicine Buddha blessings flow straight from your heart to all of them, and the medicine Buddha intelligence enables you to encompass their condition and be aware of what's good about them, what's ailing about them, what they need, what they don't need. And after you develop a certain skill and stability with this visualization practice, you then, in your healing work as a doctor or a nurse or a massage therapist or an acupuncturist or whatever it is that you might do, or even just with your own family wishing well and, you know, finding some aspirin or a Band-Aid for people, whatever, you, without mentioning it or, you know, not putting up any big pretense about it to anybody, but you avoid burnout, so to speak, by feeling your oneness with the medicine Buddha, and that becomes really a very important part of your medical training. Okay, ding, all those medicine Buddhas wake up. It's a really beautiful thing, you know. Imagine if the Western doctors from the Greek tradition, if they were taught a meditation of themselves as blessed by and then fusing with Hippocrates, the great do no harm, you know, the great Greek doctor, so that they sort of were channeling this kind of marvelous tradition. You know, after all their they never get a training like that, but they just go and take the Hippocratic Oath as a formality at the end of their medical study. But if the motivation and the mind were attended to as they should be, then this would be a part of the training. And it connects to, of course, it connects to much more training in compassion and wisdom and empathy and all kind of other things. But this is the particular medicine Buddha thing. It's particularly what the doctors learn. And if you become very skilled at it, and if you have a stabilized, if you're a little bit, have developed a little one-pointedness in your yoga of life, where you have a good sense of concentration, you can actually have a kind of vision like that of either the Buddha in front, what they call the front creation, or the self-creation, which for the self-creation, you really have to have initiation, supposedly, to try to do it yourself. But Medicine Buddha is pretty harmless, pretty nice. Then they have another wonderful one that Fifth Dalai Lama taught, where you also are sitting and then you imagine the seven other Medicine Buddhas, eight first Medicine Buddhas on top of your head in a stack, going up and up and up. And then you visualize them melting one into another and finally all of them melting into you and something like that. So that's a different, but it's all kind of variety. You know, once I was interviewed by a lady in the Times magazine, there was a lady, they still always have an interview where they interview somebody. They take a picture of you standing up, and then he's in the back part of the Sunday magazine. She interviewed me, and she had heard from some podcast or something that, although I was, this was during the Bush administration, the second Bush administration, and she heard that I visualized Dick Cheney, Darth Cheney, as my mother. And she had me elaborate that and how he was female in that lifetime and he had breasts, you know, and he had a little bonnet with his little Cheney, like Darth face, you know, like, looking down at me adoringly. And I was like slurping there and being nursed by him. And meanwhile, filling the world with evil that he was doing and making money for Halliburton and war and so on. She was so fascinated by that. And I myself am fascinated by it. Very difficult. And being a doctor in Indian and Tibetan medical culture, it's said to be not for the purpose of profit or fame or status. If your motive to become a doctor is for profit, fame, or status, you should not do so. You will not be a good doctor, and you will harm people and yourself. Develop bad karma. The only acceptable motive to be a doctor is compassion and wish to care for beings, help them take care of them, alleviate their suffering, and so on. And then it says if you have that motivation, you'll be a really good doctor, and then you will actually get status and fame and wealth. But people will be grateful. But that must not be your motivation if you want to be a good doctor. So there's a little big training in that, you know. And that's considered essential for the doctor, is motivation training, because motivation is everything in life. And so it's crazy to have a medical system where it's just for money and fame and like expertise and macho, like surgery and whatever. Like Dr. Strange, before he became Dr. Strange, remember he was like doing surgery and all proud of himself, you know, brain surgery, you know, all arrogant, you know. I'm sure you didn't see Dr. Strange because you seemed like a spiritual person, but you should. It would be a big lesson. It's a wonderful film. Benedict Cumberbatch. How did he ever get such a name? Okay, back to serious name. Seriously now. Yes, you have a question, but you have way back there. I'll have a terrible time hearing.
So is there a version?
Yes, what?
Is there a version of the Medicine Buddha for specific health concerns?
For specific what?
Health concerns.
Health issues?
Yes.
Oh, totally. But well, no. In other words, Medicine Buddha can heal all health issues and provide longevity and etc. But it isn't like a particular version for a particular one. I'm going to come now to a little bit the medicine teaching. There are sort of 404 categories of diseases in the Buddhist medicine, this is all elaborated. But the Medicine Buddha, the way he teaches, is different beings emerge from his own chakras, from his own mind. And they ask him questions, and then he answers them. That's how he gives the teaching. And there are different, you know, different parts of his person become separate beings in the medical sutra. It's very marvelous, actually. But anyway, then they have a setting of 404 main, different issues, as you're calling it, health issues. And of those 404, 101 are what they call sort of incidental, or casual, and they can just be healed by a little change of lifestyle or diet or something. They're not really, they don't need medical treatment, they just need advice. And then 101 are caused by negative spirits, some kind of curse or demon or bad spirit, goblin. They have a huge list of different kinds, And they tend to congregate in hospitals, actually, by the way, and they where people are kind of weakened, you know, because there's something wrong, something else, and they, like, infect you. And then they make it hard for regular therapies to help you, but normally would, you know. So there's 101 like that. So there are 101 where you referrals to an exorcist or a psychic lama or something like that, or in India, a psychic siddha, adept, you know, guru. And then there's 101 that are called karmic. And that's like our one where they say it's genetic, you know. You're done for, there's nothing we can do, it's your genes. But they don't ever blame genes, but they say it's your karma, you know. And then they refer you to a spiritual teacher to help you, you know, use whatever lifetime you have left or in whatever condition to develop good karma by meditating this and that, learning this and that. And then finally, there's 101 to be treated by medicine. And then of medicines, there are 18 different things to do with them. And then, there, you know, after diagnosis and so forth, and I'll talk about that. But the 18 different things are begin with, like, you know, teas, infusions, you know, teas, infusions, and then some kind of powders, and then you get finally to, then you get to pills, and then you get to... And then all kind of things like massage, hot compresses, mineral bath, herbal baths, and things like that. Lum, they have steam baths, all kinds of things like that. They have a lot of that sort of external therapy, what they call, which involve also cupping. They have cupping. They have kind of acupuncture. They have bloodletting, actually, either leeches or wet cupping, what they call, something like that. And then it goes on, and then at the very final end is, and of course, diet and lifestyle are always done. And also, lifestyle includes ethical issues about the way you're living, because that will affect your health. If your conscience feels bad because you're living and doing a certain thing, that will harm your health. And then finally, surgery is the 18th possible thing that can be done, rather than an early thing. And they had very elaborate surgery, but they had fallen into disuse in Tibet. But in Buddha's time, there was a famous doctor called Jivaka, who was the king, the doctor of a king who was his royal doctor of one of Buddha's great supporters, King Bimbisara. And also he treated Buddha for minor things and others. And he did brain surgery and so forth, even in those days. They did, sometimes, if necessary. So in other words, they deal with all different kind of conditions. But it isn't like you have a particular form of medicine Buddha to do that. Medicine Buddha can do all of those things, if you will. Okay? All right?
Music for the Bob Thurman podcast is provided by Tenzing Chogyal. Used with the artist's permission, all rights reserved. To learn more about Tenzing Chogyal, visit his website at tenzingchogyal.com. Study Buddhism up close and personal with Robert Thurman and friends on the Tibet House U.S. member trips with Geographic Expedition. Trips in 2018 include Bhutan and Mongolia. To learn more, visit bobthurman.com. Help the Bob Thurman podcast become self-sustainable and contact us about potential sponsorship opportunities. We'd love to have your support and we'd love to help you promote your project, group, or teacher. So contact me. I'm Justin Stone Diaz and I can be reached at justin@menla.org. Tasha Dalek, and thanks for tuning in.